You know, I mentioned earlier that my hobby is biblical archaeology, and there's been a tremendous amount of insight about the cultural life at that time. And it was always kind of a truism that Jesus certainly challenged certain aspects of the culture at that time. But the consensus of opinion from biblical archaeologists now, that's no longer true. He didn't challenge some of the aspects of the culture. He challenged everything of the culture. He was just remarkably counterintuitive to everything that happened at that time. It really was quite astounding. And this commandment actually is a fulfillment of that as well. I want to just describe two events. one of them, we never really look at that closely. And the other, if we do look at it closely, it's quite alarming. Both involved Mary. One involves Mary and Joseph. So think back to the time when Jesus is presented in the temple, when he's 12 years old, and they perform the normal Jewish customs at the time, and then Mary and Joseph leave. Now, they were coming from Nazareth to Jerusalem, and you might know that anytime anyone made that trip, they never made it alone, or even with a few. They were always actually in a what's called a people caravan, maybe 20 to 30 people, maybe a few donkeys, maybe even a camel, but they would travel in a large group, 20 to 30, maybe even more, because this was a temple experience, so a lot of people that really wanted to go to the temple would kind of wait for the caravan to form, and then they would all march down to Jerusalem, and it took about a week to 10 days, depending on how fast they go. So they get to Jerusalem, and they go into the temple, and they do the ceremonies, and then this group of 20 or 30 or 40 take off. And, you know, if you have a group of 10 to 20 or 30, you sometimes miss, you know, are just not paying attention to every single person. And so several days into the caravan, Mary and Joseph discover that Jesus is not with them, right? Everybody in this caravan, by the way, was almost for sure related. They were all cousins and nephews and things like that. And so it was customary for, you know, cousins and nephews to kind of hang out with each other. So it was certainly normal for Mary and Joseph to think that Jesus is with one of his cousins or relatives. But then they discover that he's missing, so they make the journey back. And they rummage around the temple, and they finally find him. And it doesn't say that he's teaching the scribes or the teachers. It says he is listening to them and responding well to their questions. Does that make sense? So, okay, that's an interesting dynamic for a 12-year-old. now, then there's this dialogue. Now, you remember the Gospels, all we know about the Gospels is that they are words printed on a page. We have no idea how they were spoken. We don't know in what manner they were spoken. We don't know if they were being yelled, whispered, questioning, sarcastic, annoying. We just don't know. I mean, they're just words on a page. You can read them five different ways. So the phrase is, Mary comes up to Jesus and says, "Did you not know we were looking for you?" Something like that. "Did you not know we were looking for you?" Now, you can read that any number of ways. "Did you not know we were looking for you? Did you not know we were looking for you?" Or maybe a New York, Brooklyn accent. "So, this is the way you treat us. Did you not know we were looking for you?" Could be any one of those. All we have is, "Did you not know we were looking for you?" So, "Did you not know we were looking for you?" But we also have Jesus' response, and Jesus' response parallels the same construction. "Did you not know that I must be about my Father's business?" Now, whatever mood you put on it, it's a brushback, right? It's a, "Did you not know?" I mean, he uses the same language. And this is to Mary, Blessed Virgin Mary. I mean, the most romantic, emotional icon we have, and they have this kind of remarkable conversation. Did you not know I must be about my father's business? Now, I should tell you that at the age of 12, when this happens, that is the official age of adulthood at that time. Jesus was not a teenager or a child. I think the official age of adulthood today is 32, 30, somewhere in the mid-30s. But in the ancient world, there was no such thing as teenagers. You went from child to adult overnight. And actually, the temple ceremony was the ceremony. That was the ceremony of moving from child to adult. So here's Jesus as a fellow adult telling his mother, I don't work for you anymore. In a sense, I don't work for you anymore. I must be about my father's business. There's a very beautiful scriptural technique that in the ancient world, when they had a character in a story, the very first time the person speaks and the last time they speak are a summary of the person's life. So the first time they speak and the last time they speak is a summary of their life. For instance, does anybody remember what Mary's first words are? That's like second. How can this be? The angel says, you're going to be the mother of our Lord, and she says, how can this be? Mary's opening line is a question. So if you have ever had a question about anything or question God, you're in very good company. Because Mary's opening line is a question. So you never have to worry about a question. A question is an honorable thing. Now you can imagine what the angel Gabriel did at that time. God, the human person is asking a question. I think God would have said something like this, answer it. We can't go forward until the human person understands and accepts, because we respect her freedom and her intelligence. We do not impose ourselves on anyone. So we have to wait until Mary says yes, which she eventually does. So her opening line is, how can this be? Does anybody remember what her last line is? Not her last appearance, but her last line. Pardon? That's the second line. Right after the question, her second line is, let it be done to me. But the last time she speaks in the Gospels, the last time she says anything in the Gospels, at the wedding feast of Cana, do whatever he tells you. So she begins, how can this be? Ah, follow Jesus, right? That's the summary. How can I answer any question? Do what Jesus says, right? That's what I said in this morning. You know, don't follow those pesky high school principals, just follow Jesus. So here we have this interesting relationship between Mary and Jesus, basically saying that at the time of adulthood, children become fellow adults with their parents, with their mother and father. You still have the title mother and father, but you no longer have the authority of mother and father, because this child now is a separate being created by God with its own plan and must be about its own business. By the way, Jesus' opening line is, I must be about my Father's business. And his last line on the cross, it is finished. I must be about my Father's business, mission accomplished, right? He speaks after the resurrection, but during his ministry is on earth. Those are the opening and closing lines. So that begins us a little bit of understanding of how, what we mean by honor mother and father. There's a difference between childhood and adulthood. With childhood, it's obedience. With adulthood, it's respect, but as a fellow adult. Now, it is much more extraordinarily countercultural in the next gospel, which occurs in the town of Capernaum, and which was Jesus' headquarters during his ministry. And he's quite popular, and everybody's kind of crowding in, and he's in a house, and he's giving a sermon, and it's just packed house, all kinds of people. And people come by and say, "Jesus, your mother, brother, and sisters are outside waiting for you, or looking for you." Now, in this ancient culture, family was everything, right? Family was, there really wasn't a state or a county or a city government. There really was only families. So family was everything. So when they say your mother and family are outside looking for you, how that translates is, sermon's over, everyone disperse, I gotta go. And then Jesus says this incredible thing to a crowd of people for whom family is everything. And he says, "Who is my mother?" You know the phrase, "Who is my mother and my brother and sisters?" Not the people who have the title, only the people who have the behavior. The people who follow my Father in heaven, right? So amongst adults, mother and father are not titles, they are behaviors. If you have the behavior, you can have the title. If you don't have the behavior, you don't get the title. Does that make sense? It's a little tough, but basically it really restores everyone to the same criteria. We all have value to the extent that we follow the Lord. Nobody can have extra special authority because you have a title. Remember I said earlier that no one can command your attention, right? Even a husband and a wife cannot say, "I want to talk about this now." You cannot command someone else. You can't say, "Well, I have the title." Well, you have to make that case up to Jesus, because he's quite clear in this gospel that who is my mother, who is my family? It's the people who act like family, or the people who follow my Father in heaven, the people who are about my Father's business, just like I am. The next commandment is do not kill, or actually it's do not commit murder, okay? So let me just say, don't commit murder, okay? Now, the next commandment after that is, so I don't think you probably, most of you, I would say, most likely none of you here are going to commit murder, but you may kill something. You may kill someone's spirit. You may kill their soul. You may kill their feelings. You may kill their sensibility, their reputation. Those are all ways that we kill people. We can, their good name, their reputation, their spirit, their morale. You can end their love. There's always kinds of ways that we can do that. And those are the areas that I think we probably know the most, because those are the ones that we actually sometimes actively try to do. We know each other's buttons. We know what makes the others tick. We know how to slice them off at the knees. And so that's a very, very serious sin, to just really kind of destroy someone else. But I want to talk a little bit about two things briefly. What if someone is trying to do that to you, right? And I'm going to talk about that tomorrow, because the rest of the commandments are fairly brief. We'll talk a little bit about adultery tonight, but do not steal, bear false witness, covet, those are very brief. So I want to spend most of tomorrow on the topic of what to do if someone is killing you. Remember, we're not about managing other people, but managing ourselves. So how can we manage ourselves when someone is killing our spirit, when someone is stepping on us and making us feel horrible? And I'm going to teach you a way in which you, from this day forward, or maybe from tomorrow's talk forward, you will never be hurt again. You will never be hurt again. So don't miss tomorrow's conference. Don't hurt my feelings by doing that. really one of the most, I think it's an important one, you know, to kind of going forward, because at some point someone's going to hurt you. I mean, that's just the way it is on planet Earth. So how to deal with that is important. Because tomorrow is Respect Life Sunday, I just want to say a few words about something that is involving killing, and that is abortion. And I want you to think about, I want you to give you this image. If you've had a chance to read my article, you know maybe what I'm going to say. If not, I'll just review it briefly here. It's a very, very simple way of really understanding just how it is, what is it, how does the Catholic Church understand this issue? Because we have a number of issues. Years ago, I wrote a book called on Catholic morality, and it was called "Don't Tell Me What to Do." Kind of based on that idea of not being able to command someone else. And I took about 30 different moral issues and just wrote 3 or 4 pages on each one, just a very, very clear, simple, quick idea of what we understand of each one. But there's about 30 issues, and you know, all of them are significant. And you can think about these issues, maybe what's in the front of your mind. Maybe it's immigration. Maybe it's the whole thing about the wall. Or maybe it's the Middle East and the war and pulling out of Syria. Or maybe it's crime, you know, or drugs, or gay marriage, or divorce, or child abuse. You know, there's all kinds of different death penalty. All kinds of different moral issues, and you can say, and you can, you know, if it's an issue that's really important to you, you could probably talk intelligently about it because you've probably read about it, and so you have a lot of information about it. So you can think that each moral book, each moral issue, has so much information about it that it could fill a book, its own book, not 3 or 4 pages like in my book, but a whole book. Here's the book on death penalty. Here's the book on war. Here's the book on immigration. And it's on a moral issues bookshelf, if you will. Now, the thing is, how are you going to prioritize that, the books on the shelf? So let's say these are the most important books here and coming back this way. So the most important book that you read first, that you really should know, is in this position, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5. I will bet if we took a poll of everyone in this room, the numbers would be different. You would have something else. You would have something on number 1. You might have something on number 2. And then we could have a lively, interesting debate. No, don't you realize that 3 should be in front of 4? No, immigration is more important than this. Well, death penalty, my God, that's more important than this. So we can debate. So where is the pro-life book? Where is the book that talks about the dignity of human life from conception to natural death? Where is the pro-life book held? Where is that? And there's going to be a lot of people that think it belongs number 1. Some people think it belongs number 2. What I am suggesting is that the pro-life book does not belong on the shelf at all. It actually is the shelf. It's the foundation on which all the other books stand. It's the ground on which all the other moral issues reside. We cannot really understand the death penalty, putting someone to death, unless we understand the idea of innocent. We can't understand end-of-life issues unless we understand what natural death means, right? We can't understand any of these things until we understand the meaning of protecting the dignity of human life from conception to natural death. That's the ground on which all the other books reside. I think that's a very, very accurate way of understanding how that fits into the whole encyclopedia of different moral issues. So my article is a rather long 4-page explanation of that. So if you haven't seen it, I think it's still in the back of the church, but it's there for your review. Let me just, so tomorrow I'll talk about gossip and rumors about you, someone trying to kill your spirit, someone trying to devastate you, or people who have just simply hurt you in such a way that it's, you know, you remember it forever. and how to get over that and how to guarantee that you will never be hurt again. And I'm not really being glib or coy. It really, you know, if you walk into any Catholic church, I just had to make sure. I know this is a Catholic church, sister. If you walk into any Catholic church, it's no accident that, generally speaking, the largest thing that you will see is someone suffering on a cross, right? Sometimes, you know, a church will have a patron saint, you know, that's quite large or something, but the common denominator, you know, in any Catholic church is this huge, front and center, massive image of a person deeply suffering on a cross. That should tell you that the place or the understanding suffering and how to overcome suffering and how to deal with suffering is central to our faith, right? Absolutely central to our faith. It's no accident why it's there. And there was never any rule in the beginning of our faith that said that. It just happened naturally as people understood the experience of Jesus, as they understood the meaning of his salvation story, as they understood the passion, they said, ah, because of the life that we lead, we need this front and center in every church. That's just a little clue, a little hint about, you know, that Jesus really does mean to give us a way to not suffer. As an example, have you ever put up a painting on the wall, a picture on the wall that hit your thumb, right? What you do is you instantly drop the hammer, you drop the picture, and you do this really funny thing. And you stare at it like that's going to make any difference whatsoever, you know. And you just stare at it, and actually psychologically, you know what happens? Literally the world disappears. There, in the entire universe, there is only your thumb. It's the only thing that exists. You just do this, right? Because you are so massively focused on this throbbing, incredible pain. So what is Jesus doing on the cross? Oh, my thumbs hurt so much. Oh, this is so painful. Oh, my God, this is terrible. What is he actually doing on the cross? Mother, here is your son. Son, here is your mother. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. To the good thief, this day you'll be with me in paradise. Right? This is what he's saying on the cross. You think your thumb hurts when you hit it with a hammer? His entire body hurts. And yet on the cross, he is not about hurt. Now, he wouldn't do that if it wasn't possible for us to follow him in that. Right? So we cannot say, well, Jesus, that was you. Try doing that in Alhambra. And when he says, follow me, he means follow us in that path, and how he was is available to us. And I'll talk about that tomorrow. But just briefly on thou shalt not commit adultery, I'll just say a couple of things about that. God designed us, as I was talking about earlier, God designed us to have meaningful talk, to enjoy the process of meaningful talk, and that naturally brings people together. And they begin to care for each other because they begin to know each other and their dreams and their hopes and their aspirations in that meaningful talk. So people fall in love. That's a beautiful thing. It's recommended that happen a lot. All right? We want that to happen as much as possible. But when do you get married? That's a whole different ballgame. When I do weddings, I'll say, here's this very nice couple, and they are good people, but that's not why we're here. There's a lot of good people everywhere. And these people became best friends, but that's not why we're here. And then they fell in love, but that's not why we're here. There's something higher than love, and that's commitment. Or as we men like to say, commitment. So commitment says, the love that I have for you today I promise I will have it for you every day, in good times and in bad, in good times and in bad. And I will be faithful only to you. So it kind of parallels the commandments, right? You will have no other gods before you, the first commandment. You will have no other spouse before you. But you never have to worry about, you never have to apologize falling in love. If you meet someone and they're wonderful people and they're engaging and you have a meaningful talk and you find your heart going out to that person, congratulations. If that person is married, then you do not act on it. As I tell people all the time, you never have to censor your heart, only your feet. You know what I mean by that? It means you don't go to that person's house, right? So you can love people, but you censor where you censor your behavior, where you actually go. And that's important because you don't want to be squashing your heart or peremptoring it or censoring yourself in that way, because that's the way God designed us, is to love people. But we have two ways of expressing it. So we have our relationship with the person that we feel about them, and then we have the physical sign of it. Okay. Every level of relationship has a physical sign. If you meet someone for the very first time, you have a low-level relationship. So there is a corresponding low-level physical sign. We shake hands. Or maybe we just even nod. Right? They match. Low-level emotional relationship, low-level physical. As you go up this ladder, it gets more involved. As you become to know the person more, a handshake is not enough. It's a hug. Or higher, hug and a kiss. Make sense? God designed us to always like that to be even, so that how we feel about the person, how we physically express our relationship matches the level of relationship, right? If you meet someone for the very, very first time, you don't wrap your arms around them and give them a big hug and a kiss, right? And people naturally feel awkward about that. In the same way, you know, I use this example of an engaged couple just a couple of months before their wedding, and all of a sudden the guy finds out he has to go on a business trip, and he's going to be gone all the way up until the wedding, and, you know, a lot of tears and everything, but what can he do? So they're very much in love. They go down to the airport. She's sobbing. He's crying. He says, well, this is it, honey. I'm getting on the plane. Put her there. You know. So, you know, this is a couple that's a few weeks away from their wedding. A handshake doesn't do it, right? So God designed us. This is just common sense. This is not like a big theological imposition. Our church understanding of sexual behavior is simple common sense, the way that God designed us. He designed us in such a way that we express a relationship with a physical sign that matches it. That's all. If you take the very highest physical, if you take the very highest emotional commitment, which is when you look at someone and you say, I promise I will give myself to you and for your happiness and only you forever. Just like the Ten Commandments. There's no other combination of words in the English language that says more than that. It simply makes sense that then that match the highest physical activity, which is intercourse. Young couples today that are engaging in intercourse that don't have the matching relationship naturally feel ill at ease, and don't mistake that, no matter what they say. We know human psychology. These people were not born with a different brain. It is a natural human event that if you allow someone to be that physically close and you're uncertain of the commitment, it is unsettling. It is unsettling. It's also true that men and women tend to look at the action differently. Women do tend to take it, intercourse, as a sign of commitment, and men look at it as a wonderful way to end the evening. So even that is a problem because they're not on the same page. And when they're not on the same page, it leads to misunderstandings. But I thought, well, no, right? And then hurt feelings. So this idea of just kind of going up the natural relationship ladder in an orderly way over time builds trust so that when they actually do make these vows on the wedding day, they're both saying the same words. One is not saying this is a great way to end the evening and this is means a commitment. They're not meaning different things. They mean the same thing. They're on the same page. And that means that's more likely to last. Does this make sense? So really, it's common sense. It's not like a big Catholic imposition or, you know, a big thou shalt not. It's just get in line with the way that you were made. And again, once again, we go back to the car manual. When we operate according to our manufacturer's instructions, this vehicle operates best. Let me just say one last thing about same-sex couples. I have a much longer article on this on my website. I decided to bring the shorter one that's based on science in case you have kids at home that, you know, are atheists or only believe, don't want to have a religious explanation. I have one back there called A Non-Religious View of Same-Sex Marriage. But it's a very common statement today for people to say, well, God made me this way, right? There's a lot of intuitive sense about that, but it misunderstands the way we understand God operates. Now, just because someone has a genetic makeup some way, we can't ascribe that to God or to give any rights for it. Now, to tell you the truth, this is the honest to God truth, no matter what you say. Nobody knows the origin of homosexuality today. No one. I mean, it is, they can't tell if it's nurture or nature. They don't know. There's actually no chemical gene that's been found. And the examination of environment and culture is extremely difficult to measure, like what affects you, your third grade teacher, or was it your fourth grade teacher? I mean, it's hard to say. So it's extremely difficult to say what the origin of is. The church actually doesn't care. You know, we have no axe to grind in that issue, like where it happens. But let's talk about genetics. There's all kinds of things that are genetically predisposition for. This is proven that you can have a genetic predisposition for violence. That has been established, that people, because there's so many violent people, it's easy to study. People can be born into the world with an antisocial behavior. There is a pre-genetic disposition for intelligence, for a genius, right? There are children born into the world who are savants, who are geniuses. None of these are a civil right. It's just what you have. If you come into the world with a predisposition to antisocial behavior, you cannot say, I have a right to rob a bank. Because I am naturally, genetically, God made me violent, so if I express myself violently, you have to take it up with God, not me. God made me violent. Sorry. Right? That's ridiculous. Because I have a musical ability, you can't say, you owe me a job on the orchestra. So genetic predisposition is not a right, and it doesn't guarantee anything. It's just something that you have to deal with. So if someone says, I am genetically predisposed to same-sex attraction, fine. You're right in line with everybody else who has some kind of genetic predisposition. It doesn't give you a right for any behavior that is by itself wrong. So, but really what I want to talk about tomorrow, just as on our way home, and then the gospel, the mass, is just dealing with this whole area of hurts and traumas and things that happen to you and to give you a way that our Lord taught to make sure that you will never feel hurt again.